Welcome to the newest episode of Walnut Grovecast. I hope that you have had a chance to vote in the Walnut Grove 1883 election, which I think is a lot of fun. To vote, visit walnutgrovecast.com and look for the link. I would like to thank the following supporters for their continuous support. David Webb, Dana Wilkins, Chantel Dubois-Nishiyama, Peyton England, Rebecca Frederick, Angela Bowen from the Looking Back on My Wonder Years, a Wonder Years podcast, Anne Quinn, Jill Stillman, Michelle Plug, Dottie Cashin, Suzanne Holland, Spunky Cheek, Sue Ingalls Wilder, Stephanie Carnes, Whitney Griggs, Leah Mitchell from the Retro TV podcast, Laura Solarin, Kim and Jack Lair from the Unsolved Mysteries Rewind podcast, Chris Hassler from the VHS Rewind podcast, Stacey Keller, Matt Mercier, Dean Butler, Gerald Lang from the OSI Files podcast, Ginny Comer, Ginny Schneider-Mitchell, Jeff Griffin, Julia Monin, Laura Furman, Megan Parker, Melissa Gilbert, The No Agenda Podcast, Rebecca Harris, Sherry Benner, Susan King, Teresa Trapp, Valerie Williams, Whitney, Julia Jin, Chris Cooling from the Forgotten TV Podcast, Don Roberts, Samantha Larson-Randall, Max Duration, Aaron Wortman, and Liz Serha, Brian S., Bobby Young, Brenda Worsley. Thank you so much for your support. If you would like to support Walnut Grovecast, please visit patreon.com/walnutgrovecast. Without further delay, please enjoy the newest episode of Walnut Grovecast. Listening to Walnut Grovecast. My name is Mark. Today I have a very special guest. Her name is Sarah S. Utoff. She is a respected authority on Laura Ingalls Wilder, one-room schools, historic foodways, and living history. Sarah knows history, which in my opinion should be a bumper sticker. And she received both her history education bachelor's and her master's of library science from the University of Iowa. Her podcast, Trundle Bed Tales, is very well-received and always brings something interesting to the table. Please welcome to the show, Sarah S. Utoff. How are you doing, Sarah?
Oh, just fine, Mark. Thank you for having me on.
We got to print those bumper stickers.
I would buy one.
I bet you buy two. but you know, you're one of these people who is a part of, I'm going to say, the Little House on the Prairie and Laura Ingalls Wilder universe that currently exists. You know, you type in any type of research or any aspect of it, even the TV shows, your name just kind of floats into it. And so I'm just always kind of curious when I come across somebody like you who shares an interest in this. Have you always been a fan of Laura Ingalls Wilder's books?
I have.
Mm-hmm.
When my mom was pregnant with me and she found out she's going to have a little girl, one of her friends said that, oh, if you're going to have a little girl, you've got to get these books. And she'd never heard of them. She was a Black Stallion girl herself.
Me too. I remember that.
And so she got the books at garage sales, and everybody was reading them to me for as long as I could remember, and I just loved them to death. And people ask me why I like them so much, and that's a really hard question for me because I'm like, why doesn't everybody like them this much?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I first discovered it when I was very young, and I think I read I don't think it was the very first book, but it was just something that opened my eyes to it. And the TV show existed at the same time. And I just kind of, I think, just fell into the world of the television show. But I did go back and finish reading it through, I think, junior high school. And I did enjoy, I enjoyed all of it. Even today, I enjoy all of the books. There are a couple of them that I've yet to read, so I am revisiting. Now, I heard at 9 years old, you put together a 4-H program that's based upon this. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in 4-H, for people who don't know it, is a youth group that is supported with the extension service for the sort of the technical colleges in the country. There's in Iowa, it's Iowa State, but they're all over the place.
Yeah, 4-H used to be really, really big when I was a kid, and I think Girl Scouts kind of took over a lot of the things that the 4-H groups were doing.
Well, it depends where you are. There are some states that still have really strong programs, but it takes the thing about 4-H is you need to have a good leader and you have to have supportive parents. And if you don't have both those things, mm-hmm. you're not going to have a very good experience. But if you do, 4-H is the best. You learn all sorts of things. And I could talk about the rest of the program about how much I love 4-H, but I won't. One of the things that you do in 4-H is you learn about public speaking by having to do presentations. And so my second year, I was going to do a presentation. Well, the first year, I was coming back from doing it at county, and we were walking in the parking lot, and my mom was starting to talk about, well, what should I do for a subject for my next year's presentation? And she said, you know, you should do one on Laura Ingalls Wilder. And the clouds parted, and the light came down, and I said, yes!
Yeah, you got the light bulb kind of just popped on.
So I just had to put it together. And then about the time there was, and I'm going to forget the name because I didn't look it up. Helen Burkheister. It's Helen Burkheister, right? Yeah. Helen Burkheister was a woman who was down in the Quad Cities, and she had this stone house that was in one of the city parks, and she had filled it with her Laura collection, and she'd go around and do speaking engagements and have programs there. And I was like, being a rather full of myself child, I said, huh, if she does that, I can do that. So that got me into reaching out and starting to do more presentations to service groups and youth groups and schools and library programs, and that's how it kind of all got started. So I owe it to Helen Burkheister.
You know, Sarah, could I ask you just to get closer to your mic? Could you? This is like a fan noise. I'm gonna write down the time.
God, but okay.
I don't know if sometimes when is it a separate microphone that you have on?
Yes.
I'm just want to make sure that it's that Skype actually is using the right mic.
Should be.
If you scratch the actual microphone, I should be able to hear it like really well. Yeah, maybe. It sounds a little bit better now though. So, all right. Okay. I'll just noting the time and I'll just kick that out. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Yeah, you're a little bit low, but I can fix that. It's not a big deal. So at what point did you step away from the books and your interest in the books and start diving deeper into the Wilder life?
Well, that sort of started out with the presentation because, you know, if you have to talk to somebody about something, you need to be able to answer questions, and you need to sort of summarize it. So I started kind of digging in more to the history, and I had a very supportive mother. She really believed in supporting kids' interests, so she took me to all but two of the Laura home sites. And if you ask my brother, he will complain mightily that he had to go, But for for his interest, she took us to tractor graveyards to get parts.
Wow.
So trust me, there's a lot more of them than there are Loris. Right?
Yeah.
But so I started doing that, and she also is a big believer in memberships. So she bought me a lifetime membership in each one of the home sites, and so I would get the newsletters, which used to be a lot more of them than there are now. And I live just down the road from the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch, which has the Laura papers. So,
oh yeah, so you have access to a lot right there, because that's also I learned this from one of your podcasts, actually, how also the Rose papers are there, the Rose Wilder papers,
yes.
Where because she had been commissioned to write a book for Herbert Hoover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's incredible that you have access like that.
Well, it is. And people out there who might be interested, you should know that it's open to pretty much anybody. And
wow.
When I was little, I used to think I'd come up with an excuse why I wanted to go over there. But they're like, they don't care. If you want to come and look, you can come and look. There's like a little half-page form you have to fill out and submit. And they are glad to have people come in and look at it. So I keep saying I need to get back over there and finish up some of the William Holtz papers. But
do you know if they're open again? Like, is that something
no.
that's no, they're not open yet.
No, they are part of the National Archives system, and that means that they are controlled quite a bit by some things in Washington. One of those is the cost of their photocopies, which is like 50 cents a page, because that's what it is in Washington. And one of them is they are closed for this. However, they are going to be doing programming. And next month in November, I'm going to be doing one of my Laura programs for them. And people can watch it over the internet. And
oh, really?
I hope they enjoy it. Yep. It's going to be one of my programs that I don't give as much, so I'm really kind of looking forward to it. I used to speak at Hoover every year, and they've kind of broken it up and gotten different people now, but I didn't want people to be coming back and hearing the same thing all the time, so I used to invent a new program every year, and this is one of those, and I'm glad to do it again.
Wow, that sounds like really an incredible thing, and I'm definitely going to want to look into that for myself, but also if you'd like, I would love to share it with the people who are listening right now. I'm sure that they would love to check that out and see your work at work. Why is it that Laura Ingalls Wilder's papers are in the Hoover? Because that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I can understand why the Rose Wilder stuff is
okay.
there.
Well, what happened? For those of you who are not archives people, the presidential library system, as it is now, was set up during the Roosevelt administration because I'm going to cut out some of the stuff I usually say, because he wanted a place to put his papers. And so they had to go through and make this deal that the government was accepting ownership of the library and the papers. And after messing around with it for quite a while, they decided that that going forward, any president could set up a library if they wanted to, and previous presidents could also set them up. And for, you know, current presidents, they just back the trucks up to the White House, load the stuff in, and take it off to the library. But presidents that were before that had to kind of dig to build up collections.
Yeah, wow.
And when Hoover was not Hoover himself, but when the people doing Hoover's were working on it, one of the things they had found out was about Rose's Hoover biography, which was the very first biography of Hoover published as a book. And so they wanted her papers about Hoover.
Wow.
Do you want to wait till the clock gets done? Can you hear the bongs?
I can.
Okay, well, wait a minute. Okay, there we go. all right. So they wanted her papers about the Hoover biography. And so they went to Roger Lee McBride, who was Rose's heir and had her papers. And they said to him, well, we really want her stuff that she did on Hoover. And he said, well, it's just really, it's too mixed up with the other Rose papers. You have to take all the Rose papers. And so they said, sure, fine, we'll do that. And then they actually got there to pick them up from McBride. And he said, you know what? They're just too messed up. All Laura's papers are in here, too. You have to take the whole thing. And they were like, well, we really
get the hand truck.
But he said, no, if you don't take the Laura papers, you can't have the Rose papers. So they said, okay, and took them.
It's a great way of it being preserved. I mean, what better place for it to be preserved, right?
It really is. And to have, make sure it's something that is funded and properly taken care of in terms of, you know, humidity and long term. Mm. And it's really, really great. And after Hoover's papers himself, the Laura papers at the Hoover Library are their second most heavily used collection. And they get all sorts of requests for people to look at them or to get photocopies. And
they're like, who knew?
Yes. And I will also give you a warning that you really need to keep asking about stuff, because they do have a finding aid, which is archive talk for a list of the kinds of things they have in the various boxes. But they also have photos and videos that aren't listed in the Rose Finding Aid that you just have to know to ask.
Wow.
And there's,
it's like a secret menu at In-N-Out Burger.
Oh, it is. I hate off the menu things. I hate them. You should be able to know what's there.
Yeah.
But then there's also a collection by William Holtz, who wrote the Rose biography. And I think there's 7 boxes of that.
Wow.
And I haven't made it all the way through his papers yet. That's what I was saying. I need to get back over there.
And Rose would remain friend, I don't know about friendly, but have a correspondence with Hoover for years after that, right?
Yeah, Rose could get in little moods, but I would say overall they were friends.
Yeah, I it's very interesting. You know, it's just weird to kind of think of these people interacting all the way back to the world of the 1860s and 70s, you know, to our little Laura. So, you know, somehow having it start there and end up there, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, about your radio show, Trundle Bed Tales is your radio show. I refer to more of a podcast, so I apologize if you feel so. It's more of a radio show. I think it's interchangeable.
It really is a podcast, but a lot of the people I'm aiming at, I don't think are necessarily listening to other podcasts. I mean, a lot of them are, but, you know, for the woes who don't and they're looking at stuff and they're trying to figure out what something is, radio show, I think, is a little...
Yeah, digestible.
Yes, exactly.
There's no doubt about it. But yet you have nearly 250 episodes. I've listened to it now for about a year and a half. I listen to one podcast religiously, but your podcast I will return to, probably at least every few weeks and check out what you're up to. And I always find something interesting there. But looking back at 250 episodes, I mean, this podcast is a little over 100 episodes. But 250, that's quite an achievement. But looking back, what are some of the highlights of your radio show that you think are just some of the things that you're really proud of or you're really happy that you had touched upon? Is that a tough question? I know, out of 250, choose two, you know.
Yeah.
It's not fair.
Well, I would sort of divide them I kind of have a system of doing different types of episodes, mm-hmm. and I'm not as good as I should be about getting regular episodes out. I'm not. But it's so of the one people that I've interviewed, I would probably say that John Miller and Bill Anderson.
Bill is such a nice guy. Isn't Bill the nicest guy in the world? Seriously.
Really is. And it's, I always think it's the weirdest thing because, you know, I have known who Bill Anderson is pretty much my entire life. And I always think that I'm just this person doing my little Laura stuff, making myself happy over here. And people know me when I go places now, and I just always find that very weird. But Bill knows me now by sight, and he'll like wave. And
that's awesome.
It's just like,
yep. You know, when I finally speak to some of these people, it's sometimes a little jarring. I don't get starstruck very easily, but speaking to him was a real honor.
Yes.
Dean Butler was another person who it was a true honor to speak with, and. Everyone else was just really just so down to earth. Not to say that they aren't down to earth, because Bill is super down to earth. It's just those were the ones I kind of put up on a little bit on a pedestal, I guess. So it was a little bit strange.
It is strange when you it's especially I always say people, you know, there's always those questions and they're always saying things like, well, would you want to meet Laura? Or, you know, if you could have anybody to dinner with you, would you pick Laura? And I'm like, no, because that would be a really awful conversation because she is just going along her normal business. And here she's met this person who she never saw before, who knows so much about her
Too
life.
Too much.
Think about how freaky that would be. Yeah. I mean,
you are Big Brother at that point, you know, it's wow. I never thought of it that way. It's kind of, if you were to meet this person, I mean, their opinion of you might be kind of squinting at you a little bit. Like, who is this person?
Yeah. I mean, it would be totally weird. You'd totally be like,
I love that, but we love it. We embrace it. Yes. And we can't learn enough about these people.
No, and I hope Laura would like me eventually when she got to know me. But, I mean, who am I to her? Just the stupid little kid from Iowa.
Now, I've heard you say that Laura Ingalls Wilder, the woman who wrote the books, mm-hmm. is just as, if not more, interesting than the little girl who is in those books.
Oh, I think so. I think that as a farm wife and as a writer are really, you know, powerful stories, mm-hmm. and they're not stories that get told a lot. In fact, one of my programs, which I don't get asked to do very much, I wish I did because it's one of my favorites, is The Mansfield Years. And I talk about the different roles that she played in the Mansfield community. And there's just so much there to talk about and to know about. And she was a club woman. And I always find that just people do not appreciate what club women did enough. They really don't.
Well, what is a club woman?
It used to be that there would be like service groups. So like the Farm Bureau Ladies, and the Eastern Star, and the Just a Mirror clubs.
Gotcha.
And, you know, so they would be clubs that where women would get together probably about once a month, sometimes a little more than that, depending on the club, and you would have service projects. So, for instance, my grandmother was in the Farm Bureau Ladies, and one summer, she spent the entire summer driving Johnson County, and that's the county that we live in, mm-hmm. Driving Johnson County and marking down on a map every place where there should be a stop sign because, you know, it was like roads teed into each other or it would, you know, it'd be easy to
get. So it has a community slant to it.
Yes.
Sure.
And there got to be stop signs every place she put on the map. And they did things like They got libraries going. Most, I would say, libraries in Iowa got started by women's clubs. Women's clubs did all sorts of fantastic work, and they have been slowly dying. It's really sad.
But I'd love to see a return to these type of things where people do get together in small groups and make these kind of community changes.
It would be nice. And part of it was that you had women who worked, but they worked at home, so they had time. They could arrange their schedule to have these meetings. And that's really part of why they're kind of dying off. That and that people, you know, when they are home, you know, they're on their computer or they don't want to leave again. And it's really too bad. There in Des Moines, there is this women's club that, I mean, my God, they had this mansion with an auditorium, a huge auditorium in the center of it. And they're down to being this teeny tiny little club, though they were smart enough to put money when they were bigger and doing better in sort of an endowment. Mm-hmm. So it'll keep going for a long time. But the club itself is now, it's just a small club now. And it's too bad because women's clubs did a whole lot. And Laura's women's clubs, to get back to the subject, did things like get the library going, the Wright County Library going in a branch of it in Mansfield. They did study clubs. I mean, just all sorts of service projects and things. And it just, women's clubs did so much good for this country. And now people have just completely forgotten about them. And it's one of my things that I get on my soapbox about, which is why I talked about it that long, because yeah. I really do think they're important.
You know, I was, I'm a part of our Board of Education here. And it kind of reminds me that a little bit, of course, that, you know, it's a little bit different, but I mean, you know, getting together though in a small group and discussing very serious things and actually having some level of having somebody who you could speak to and, you know, get somebody's ear to it, it's a really powerful thing. So, yeah, I would love to see more of this type of thing. And if anything, this pandemic that we're going through right now, we're all at home and we see the little things that bother us, and we're starting to like learn what neighborhoods are again, maybe.
Yes.
And maybe I have a little bit of hope that maybe people are going to come out of this with a feeling of pride for where they live and their areas, and maybe to make some changes.
So. Yeah, I think that there could be a lot of positive things happening, but yeah. You just have to see, and it'll change once everything's opened up again. But hopefully people will remember some of the stuff. I keep saying that the theme for 2020 is what were you doing before? Because people keep announcing they're doing these things, and yeah. It's sort of like, why weren't you doing this all along?
Everybody has the new idea, you know?
Yeah.
So as Laura is an adult, throughout your research, was there any bit of information that you came across that maybe didn't sit well? I mean, no one is perfect, but, or maybe even just surprising information that you kind of uncovered.
Oh, Laura is perfect, but no, she wasn't.
Laura.
I mean, she was very, very stubborn about some things, and, I've heard especially lots of people talk about some of the things they talk about in Prairie Fire, mm-hmm. which is the big biography on Laura that came out 2 years ago.
Yeah, you know, I literally just bought that book 2 days ago. I've yet to read it. I'm anxious. We spoke a little bit before we started recording about my list of books on to read before I can get to things. But yeah, that gets read before Gettysburg.
Well, you know, I could talk about that a while. But, anyway,
but it's a worthwhile read?
I think it is. I think you have to be aware of who your narrator is. Hmm. Because she definitely comes at it from a viewpoint. And I've heard a lot of people talk about the book and not really seem to get that. But it's well worth reading, and I've got a couple things that I want to follow up on from it, so that's always a good sign in a book.
So there's, you know, so there is, you know, new information that kind of gets uncovered here and there. And I think maybe when you said before that you would never want to maybe have dinner with Laura because it would be kind of weird to, you know, meet somebody who knows so much about you. You know, it's like, I think sometimes we forget that these were real people, you know, genuine people with real families, real emotions. And just kind of, you know, it's wild. But then we get into the world of fiction or dramatized fiction. And I wanted to know what your opinion of, and go lightly here, on the TV show Little House on the Prairie. What is your opinion overall of this quest?
Well, I would have to say that when I was little, I really liked the television show.
Mm-hmm.
It was my favorite. It used to air on one of the television stations that, you know, back before everything was digital, you used to be able to get television stations that weren't in your area.
Oh, sure. So yeah, you get the rabbit ears.
Yes. And it used to be on Channel 6 on Sunday morning, so we'd watch that. So it was after Sunday school. And it was, I always looked forward to it. There was that and Grizzly Adams.
Yeah, sure. Those two go side by side somehow. I don't know.
Yes, they do. It was, and I always enjoyed watching it. And I will say that the pilot movie is incredibly well done. I mean, it really presents the book very, very well. And there have been, you know, a couple of other attempts to kind of show that book, and they haven't been nearly as well done. And I definitely think they deserve credit for that.
Yeah, I think the TV show is a lot of fun. And but it's over. You know, it's kind of, all right, 9 seasons, it's a lot of episodes, but it's done. So what I think is so interesting is that so many people just leave it alone there and they walk away and they just maybe watch the episodes again. But if they were to just pick up these books, there's a whole new universe of stories that they had no idea about, new dimensions of these characters that are coming from a different, from a more fact-based. Now, we have, of course, these are not exact records of history, but at the same time, they're probably, if you love the characters and you love the stories, this is about as close to reality as you can get, right?
Yes. I mean, definitely these are her story, but she was trying to make it a good story people would be interested in. So they might leave things out, or they might put in things that, you know, didn't happen to her, but she heard of them happening to somebody else, and it worked well with the story, and they might rearrange things, and they might push people together to be one character when they really were different people, just because it makes the story better.
Now, the title of your podcast comes from one of her, the proposed title of her book, wasn't it?
Yes.
And I love that. I love that connection.
Well, when I was getting ready to start doing things online, I wanted a title so I'd have something to put it all under. And I didn't want to do just Laura Ingalls Wilder because, you know, not thinking of myself as an expert, but I always, you know, don't want to put myself in the position of speaking for her because I can tell you what I think, but I can't tell you, you know, what, I can't be sure of what she thinks.
Sure.
So I didn't want to just say Laura because I think that's stepping a bit too far. And there were already pages that were Frontier Girl and Pioneer Girl. And so I had always really liked the Trundlebed Tales name off of that list of proposed names. And so it had, there was a connection there with Laura, but it was a little more subtle than some of the things. And so I thought, you know, I really don't think it would have been a good name for Little House in the Big Woods, but I think I could do something with it to tell tales about Laura.
There's something English about it. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the trundle bed and the tails. I don't know. It doesn't really feel to me. It doesn't fit either. I definitely think she made a or whether it was it her choice or was it the publisher's choice at that point?
Well, they were going back and forth, and they actually changed it for a little. They kind of messed around with it a little bit.
Sure.
So I don't know if you'd say that it was all of either one of them that just sort of slowly came together. But and then I changed it a little bit then too for the Trundle Bed Tales, because Trundle Bed is really supposed to be two words, but I've mushed it together so I'd have the two strong T's when I wrote it out, which is more than anybody cares. But as a graphic designer, I think you probably appreciate the balance.
The aesthetics of the way a word looks is very important. Now, you also seem to have a true love of 19th century life, which I'm going to guess is deeply associated with your love of Wilder's work. But at the same time, you also seem to embrace it on a genuine level. Does that extend to cooking and clothing? And did you get into gardening and farming?
Yes, definitely.
Homesteading.
I don't know that homesteading would be a lot of I'll tell you an example for that. I can tell you that I would not mind having to carry, I would be okay having to carry clean water in, but you need a drain to carry the dirty water out. It's just, I was the oldest grandchild of my generation. So when I was little, I had loads of great-great aunts and great-great uncles and, my great-grandparents. And so I dealt a lot with people who had done a lot of those same things in their life. And, you know, being the first kid, you know, there weren't other kids for me to play with, so I was hanging out with the adults and hearing their stories and things. And, you know, I live on a farm, so we still, you know, feed the sheep and make hay and work cows somewhat. And we had a wood stove all the while I was growing up, so we had to cut wood. So a lot of that stuff we always just kind of did, that it sort of comes with the older kind of agriculture as opposed to agribusiness kind of farm. And then when I was in, I just finished high school, and I got a job at Usher's Ferry Historic Village, and that was a living history site, and so they had me cooking on the wood stove. And once you start doing something there, you want to be right. You want to have the right clothes. You want to have the right food. You want to have the right recipes. So it just draws you in. The more you do, the more you need to.
It's a slippery slope. So
it is. It's a very slippery slope.
Yeah.
And so that's how I kind of really got into to doing a lot of the everyday history. And really what I am most interested in is the social history of it, the how people did things back then, how they cooked and cleaned and made it through the winter and did food and built buildings. And I find it just fascinating, all this different stuff that was going on in the 19th century. So, yes, I really am interested in all of it, probably more than I should be.
So it didn't really start as a kind of a cute hobby. This was something that you did on a daily basis growing up. And then I guess as you got older, you just applied these, things that you just knew. This was all second nature in a lot of ways, except you went to take the next step and do the recreation.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say it was too far in that. I mean, we lived in a house and we had televisions and we had radio and running water. So it isn't like that we were really.
You're an Amish. Yeah. And,
yeah. But, yeah, there were definitely things that we did that Laura would have done too. Like bottle feeding a calf. There's probably not a lot of people who bottle fed a calf when they were growing up.
I never did. You know, I should. That's something that should be on my bucket list.
I really like it. The only thing bad about bottle feeding a calf or a lamb is they have, it is in their DNA that they, to get more milk, butt their mom, and then she lets down more milk. So as you're trying to get them to drink out of the bottle, they're like waving their heads at you, which is not great. But other than that, yeah, it's really a... So I did a lot of stuff Laura would have done using, you know, different equipment, but, you know, doing it. So I think I have a good grasp on the kinds of things she did, but I say that as I think that because, you know, unless you can go back in time, who knows?
Now, one of the things I came across while reading a bit about your work is a program that you had put together called In the Kitchen with Laura, which was it was basically for people who are interested in old-fashioned cooking methods.
Yes, that is one of my top three programs that I get asked to do the most. And I also have used it to – I do blog posts on it, and I do little videos on it, and I do podcasts on it. But basically what I do is I mix the history of food with Laura's stories, things that she would have done. And if we do the program, for instance, we talk about how the plums, drying the plums and how that would have worked. And we make biscuits and we make ginger water and just kind of go through how her life cooking would have changed as she went on in years, and people really seem to enjoy it. It's a very hands-on program, and then when I do the follow-ups, the videos, the podcasts, I dig a little deeper into individual subjects. Yeah. I just did a blog post last week, I think, on salt rising bread as an instance of the kind of things to do.
I'm a Boy Scout leader, so and my son is a Boy Scout. So we have really embraced this outdoor cooking stuff. So I've always enjoyed the whole concept of building a fire and cooking over the fire and having just having that tripod basically holding like a Dutch oven or something. And yeah, I would love to go to that. I wish I lived anywhere near you. That sounds really, really fun. I also heard on one of your episodes where you were talking about the ginger water and basically how I guess there's some type of question as to you can't have too much. I guess ginger is upsetting to some people's stomach. I thought it was soothing. But you were saying like you can have as much as you can tolerate.
Ginger water is something people are very divided on. They either think it's best flavor ever and they ask me for the recipe, or they can't get through one swallow.
I love ginger. It's the best.
And I like it. I mean, I have made, I don't know how many gallons and gallons and gallons of ginger water. I not only just for Laura stuff, but when I worked at Usher's Ferry for demonstrations, so I am very, very familiar with making ginger water. And I think it's fine, but you get the strongest reactions from people. But if you like it, you can basically have probably as much as you want. And the reason that you drink ginger water is because if you're really hot and you drink cold water, your stomach will clench. It's very painful. You do not want that to happen.
Yeah, it's like a military thing, too. I've heard. I've never been in the military. But that room temperature water is best. It goes through your system so much easier than cold.
Yeah. I at one time, and I was older, I should have known this, but it was really hot at Usher's, and I was in a hurry, and I just drank a whole big thing of cold water, and I went, oh, I'm an idiot. Really clenched on my stomach, and I was like, oh, no, why did I do that? I know better than that.
Now I'll learn again. So while we're going through this entire pandemic, you know, one day we're shut down, one day we're opened up. It's, you know, so crazy. I find personally that Laura's work comes up more and more. You know, the writing of the period of time. People love to talk about how people basically got through a lot of different, you know, tough times. Are you finding a newfound interest in Laura's work?
Well,
there's always been an interest, in my opinion, anyway. But there seems to be more of it. I don't know.
Well, it's right now. There is definitely, I think, a interest in Laura for people who are doing things like making their own bread that they hadn't done before.
Mm-hmm.
And you always see a surge of things. Like every time there's a blizzard and somebody's lost power, they always say, oh, it's just like Little House. And there's, you know, see people wearing a flowered dress. It's just like Little House. It's hard to say that there's a lot more because really, and I think a really true way, Laura is sort of everybody's model of the past. Even if they really don't know anything about Laura, even if what they're saying is ridiculous, they, you know, it's Laura that they pull up and her family in terms of how people lived. Mm. And I think that's true of any time. I mean, probably about, oh, it's been years and years ago now, but I was at the Jamestown Settlement, which is a reenactment of a historic village about the Jamestown Settlement in Virginia. And they had a house there, and it had a chimney, and I was in there taking pictures and looking to see what they had for equipment. And like I said, food waste person, taking pictures of things nobody else cares about. But a dad came in with his two daughters, and he pointed at the fireplace and was saying, look, girls, it's just like Little House in the Prairie. Well, he was about 200 years and 2,000 miles wrong. But that is their model. And I think it's true of a lot of people that even if they don't like Laura, if they are blaming her for a lot of things, it's still Laura that is the model that they're reacting to. So she really is, I think, a huge undercurrent in people's lives. She isn't quite as visible as she was, you know, earlier decades on, but I think she is planted in everybody's heads.
Yeah, she's our American girl, really.
Yes.
And one of the things, another thing that you seem to have a passion for is teaching. And what do you feel kids can learn from 19th century Laura that maybe they're not learning from, like, their everyday ways? You know, I think there's so many different stories there, but do you have anything that you bring to the table whenever you meet a kid who kind of thinks, like, well, what am I going to learn from this 150-year-old story?
Well, I think that just living or just learning the history of the country is kind of important.
Sure.
But in terms of every day, I would say people get out of Laura's books how to do things. Because today, really, you get kids and you ask them, and they – I'm going to wait for all the noises to go down for
That's
a second.
Fine. I live right near JFK, so I'm used to big noises.
Yeah. All right, there it goes. All right, kids don't really get a lot of how to do everyday things, where a lot of things come from. Where does food come from? You get people and they are honestly thinking food just magically appears in the grocery store. Sure. It never occurs to them. It has to come from somebody someplace else. And they don't necessarily think of, you know, seeing a house and thinking how it has to be designed and how it has to be built. And the idea that you can, you know, like start with one thing and then just keep adding to it to make a house, that houses aren't just, you know, a done thing, mm-hmm. and that you're going to recycle stuff and reuse it. And those are all kind of ideas that I don't think a lot of people get in their everyday lives anymore. My example that I always say is, you know, you were talking about cooking over a campfire, and I don't know how much specialized equipment you have, but one of the things you might have would be a spider, which is a cast iron pan with three legs.
Yes, I have a few different ones like that.
Yeah. See, they're awesome, aren't they?
I didn't know they were called a spider, though. Wow, I'm learning. Yeah.
So, historic food ways. Laura describes it as a frying pan with legs. Well, if you know what a frying pan is, if you know especially what a cast iron frying pan is, and you know how it works and you've seen it, that makes a lot of sense that it's a frying pan with legs. If you have never seen your folks cook on a stove with a cast iron frying pan, yeah. That picture is going to mean absolutely nothing.
You have no idea. It's like you're thinking of legs. Yes. Like little Lego legs or something.
Yeah. So and I think it's an important introduction to a lot of things that people should be learning that they aren't necessarily.
Now, one of the things, you've been published a lot and you've written quite a lot. Have you considered a book?
I always have considered a book. And actually, I am working on... Well, I have kind of small starts to two different books that I haven't finished them yet, and I need to really.
I just think you have it. It's there. And, you know, I think you know it's there. It's just you have to, you know, do it because I think you just have a story to tell here, a story for Laura, you know, through you. And I know I would buy it, and I know I would read it.
Well, that's very nice of you. I hope I can get it done. I will tell you what they both are, not that you really care. But
no, I do care.
One of the books I want to put together is questions that people ask about Laura with the answers. Because you see so many people that are working on something and they discover something and think they're the first person to ever ever do it. And it's like been known for a long time if they had read the Laura literature, because there's quite a bit, that this is not a shock to anybody. But so I'd like to put together something that has Laura basics in it, mm-hmm. so that people would, you know, not necessarily think they had to start all over again, because you don't. I mean, people have been putting work onto Laura research for ages. I have one of my favorite theses that I have, because another thing I do is collect Laura theses, there's one from the 50s that is just awesome. So people have been doing Laura scholarship for a really long time, and there is absolutely no reason to start over if you're going to be doing Laura work. So that is one of my projects. And my other project is I want to do a Laura biography that is more from a Midwestern point of view, because a lot of the books that have come out recently about Laura have been by people with a very East Coast viewpoint.
I'm just joking.
But I mean, isn't that isn't a valid way to look at it.
No, it doesn't really kind of, yeah, it's another point of view, sure, but is it the proper point of view?
I don't know if
I agree with it.
It isn't the one that that Laura wrote with. And I think it can be really hard to understand people. If you aren't looking where, if you aren't standing where they stood and looking out on it, you know, it's, I always, all right, this is my favorite thing I'm going to tell you. This is going to be in chapter one of my book if I get it finished. Actually, this part's actually written already. if you go to all the different home sites, they all have a different Charlotte doll. Now, all of those Charlotte dolls are coming off of the same two descriptions in the book, but the way they have interpreted them is very different, and all the Charlotte dolls look very different.
Oh.
And that is sort of it. They're describing a Charlotte doll one way, and I want to try and help people get a closest view possible on how Laura would have seen and described the Laura doll or the Charlotte doll.
So you have your own, I guess, understanding of what the Charlotte doll looked like.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, things like that I think are important. And I do think that it's important to have, you know, to have a book written or a record done by somebody who knows the area, who knows the same, even if it's, you know, of course, different times, you know, 100-year difference. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm a big believer of, I guess, the basic spiritual belief of it. Only somebody from the area would really be able to truly understand.
Well, yes. I mean, you really...
It's a little esoteric, but sure.
It does shape your viewpoint. Well, I'll give you another example. For example, if you read the Laura books, it sounds like they have done this incredibly clever and unique thing, making the hay twists. And if you go to a pier and you look in the historical records they have and the newspaper articles and the firsthand accounts of people living those early years, people all over the state made hay twists. And frankly, I'll skip you my story about where I think it came from. But, you know, it was just something everybody did. And if you don't understand that it's something everybody did, you're going to have a different picture of it in your head. And, you know, it could even be, moving on to another example, it'd be like a cliche. If you read older books, like I do too much, there will be lines in there that people used all the time, and they would recognize them immediately as cliches, and they will have now fallen out of favor, so people today wouldn't necessarily realize what that was referring to. So that's my idea for my book, to try and come up with one that would give people a version of Laura's life that would be as close as possible to how Laura viewed it and what Laura would have known, and to help them kind of apply that to the book, to see the cliches, to understand what's really there and what she really meant.
Well, you're trying to be as accurate as possible, which I think is why you went into this field in the first place, right? To learn the most correct version.
Yes.
It's so important to know as close as possible what was meant and also what actually happened. And
yes,
I think I love the fact that, you know, I wouldn't say it's a perfectionist type of thing, but it's just, there's an accuracy there that I think that you're seeking. And to put that out there, I think that's wonderful. I think that's something that maybe the Laura Ingalls Wilder universe could use a little bit of a fine tuning.
I think so.
So I do want to just mention your websites. There's a number of different places where you can listen and find stuff. There's trundlebedtales.com. It's the same name on Twitter, trundlebedtales. You also have a WordPress site, trundlebedtales.wordpress.com. And I'll put a link to everything in the show notes, but you have a lot of stuff that you've actually written for the littlehouseintheprairie.com website, which I was reading through, and I just love the fact that you work so closely with them. Of course, they have such a respect for the history of Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's good to see that they, although they embrace the television show just in a large way, they embrace the actual history as well. And I think that's a really, it's a tough thing to do both, right?
Yes.
But yeah, it's a respectful type of thing to do, I think.
Yes.
You can't love one without the other, kind of, because I just feel like the television show really brought to the table the continuing of the legacy. I mean, sure, it was very popular before the television show, but I definitely think that the television show opened a lot of people's eyes to Laura. And although maybe they took their eyes off of the literature, I think that it also opened the eyes to a lot of people to seek it out. Maybe even you. I wonder. Your mother forced those books down your throat when you were a kid. I'm kidding.
I did the book first. But there are definitely a lot of people who started with the TV series or who found out Laura existed through the TV series. And that was definitely a good thing. And that was really... If you can't say anything else, it was definitely a publicity factory for the books. No. So, and we are all very grateful for that, because I think they really did help spread awareness of it, and that there were these home sites, and you still run into people and they're like that. You know, like the TV show, and they don't know their books. They don't know you can go visit the home sites. And they always start saying that they're an expert, which is one of the reasons I say respected authority. But
yeah, I would never call myself an expert ever. But that's why I reach out to people like you, because I have so much respect for what you're just doing all the time. I mean, if you follow your Twitter feed, you're always posting something. It's not always about Little House on the Prairie or Laura's work, but it's something that's associated to the universe of it. And I tend to use the word universe because there's so much that surrounds it. Now, having to do with your upcoming presentations, I did find a page for fall of 2020 for you. And, I was just wondering, I didn't want to just kind of throw it out there, but, are all of these open to the public, or... This is an OLLI virtual class, but I don't know if that's open to the public.
it is, but you have to register for the series, and there is a charge for that one. For the Hoover one, that's going to be free and open to the public.
I see. So, and that's November 19th, 2020 at 6 p.m. Central Time, I think.
Yes.
I'm Eastern time, and as you know, New Yorkers are, it's all that matters, right? Eastern.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing how many things that is that you find out.
Hey, even the Wilders came to New York. Come on.
Yeah. Yep. They did come from New York.
So, Monroe, right? I actually visited Monroe, last summer.
Malone.
Why did I say Monroe? I'm sorry. Malone. But I did visit there, I think I visited the right town. No, I did. But we went on like kind of a road trip out of nowhere, and we were passing by there anyway. We're on our way to Niagara Falls, and like, hey, let's make a stop. And my wife just basically entertained me. She's like,
"Well, it's such a nice place. It really is."
I had a nice time.
They were one of the last home sites to really get going. But they did things right. They brought in an archaeological crew of students from one of the nearby colleges and tracked down exactly where things were, what the footprints were of the buildings. And they just did a really nice job. And I always tell people that it's a long drive down a 2-lane road from anywhere.
Yeah, our GPS took us to this other place, and I was like, this isn't it. And but it's a small little place. It's called the Wilder Homestead, and It's a really just lovely thing. The people there were really nice, and they heard of my podcast, so that was nice. And yeah, I mean, we hope to return. It's really not that far from where I live, so.
And they have barns. I always like that, because too many of the Laura home sites, the focus is just on the house. And if mm-hmm. you live on a farm, the barn and the outbuildings are just as important as the house. So I love that they have all the barns there.
I love that it exists, you know, and like what I said, this Laura's like our American girl, you know, this is our American girl's, you know, history. And this is, you know, Manzo's history. And it's just an important part of our American history. But Sarah, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. You know, I've been following your work for so long, and I'm really honored to have stolen an hour of your time tonight.
Oh, no, I'm very glad to come on.
I'm glad.
Think it's really great to see other people doing work and research about Laura and helping spread the word and talking about how much Laura has helped them in their lives, because you hear a lot of negative stuff.
Too much negative, yeah.
And there are reasons for that, good reasons and bad reasons. But it's good to have people talking about the good, too, because I think it's important to remember both positives and negatives. Just because there are negatives in the world doesn't mean that's the only story you should be telling.
Well, of course. And I just... You know, of course, we're talking a little bit, we're alluding to some of the more questionable things that might raise an eyebrow these days in some of the writings. And it's just, it's an honest depiction. It's there's no reason to turn away from it. You know, if anything, just, you know, embrace it and understand, try your best to understand it and learn from it. I mean, that's what it's for. That's what history is for.
Yes. That is definitely true.
But Sarah Utoff, I want to thank you again. You're welcome back anytime. I hope that in the near future, I am ordering an Amazon book with your name on it. I definitely think you have that book in there. And again, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough.
I really appreciate having you on, and I hope that some of your listeners just found out about me and they can look for everything under Trundlebed Tales.